All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters, what the fuckabilies, what the fuckadelics, what the fuckminster fullers. All right, man, women. I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. Larry Wilmore is on the show today from The Daily Show and also the designated heir to The Colbert Show a year. Well, how long before? How does that feel to get a gig that you got to wait like a year to step into? I mean, the excitement of knowing it's like, all right, you're the guy. All right, the buzz goes down. All right, you just wait it out. I don't know. I think I would go crazy. I don't know if that's the best situation. It seems like the best way to do it is just hold on to the information until a few weeks before or a month before, just to keep the juice going. And I don't know if they can overthink it. He's a great guy. He's a smart guy. He's a funny guy. I was happy to talk to him. But he's a bigger man than me, not shredding himself, knowing that that's going to happen. I mean, Conan, you had that Tonight Show gig 6 years out. That didn't pan out well. Now, I'm not trying to be negative. I just don't know how I would handle that. Hey, we got a gig for you in about 5 years. I mean, holy shit, so much could happen. I could be a rabbi by then. I may be living in the mountains. I may have gnawed my arm off in my bed just because I had a bad dream. I don't know where that came from, man. I'm operating on full cortisol almost all the time. I did a little, I was researching stress with this video. I'll talk about it another time, about the difference between, you know, stress's effect on the body. Oh my God, sorry. No cough button here. Stress's effect on the body. Like, you know, most of what we activate all the time was put in place for our survival, to run away from lions and tigers and dinosaurs, depending if you believe that perhaps people were around with dinosaurs, that there was probably a lot of stress in those times, almost always. And a lot of the sort of stress reaction amped up, accelerated heart rate, all the stuff that comes with panic and anxiety and getting jacked up, anger, just all that fuel was really designed to get us the hell out of bad situations. And in the world we live in, there's not a lot of those situations necessarily in your day-to-day life, but man, isn't your head full of them. I got a head full of bad situations. I got a head full of panic and worry. Why? Because I can't fucking turn it off. I'm not taking care of myself in the right way. I'm doing the therapy thing. I'm trying to stay like a recovered person. But man, my cat gets sick and I'm beside myself. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do without him if that happens. Look, my heart and my respect goes out to you. Those of you who can handle children. I really think I don't have children because I am not designated to have children. I think I'd be a good father. There's no doubt about that. But I think I'd be a panicky, worried father that would drive everybody, well, my wife and my child, when it became conscious, fucking crazy. I would just be consumed with panic. I believe my parents were. I believe that what they really did, instead of love, was extreme worry, extreme concern. Because I just had this weird realization about this. Not that any of this psychobabble matters to anybody, but maybe it does. You know, because Monkey got sick. I told you about that last week. And then, you know, when I got him back from the vet, I was waiting on a urinalysis results because everybody assumed, well, it's a urinary tract thing. It's those fucking crystals or whatever. So they got to put poor Monkey under to take pee out of him because he's a nutbag and he's full of stress. I don't know if I'm causing that. Maybe I've made my cats not unlike me. Maybe my cats are prone to panic. Maybe they're, you know, maybe I'm sitting around panicking about them and they're sitting around going like, oh God, here he is. Oh, he's going to clank that thing. Not the guitar. Not the, oh God, here we go with the guitar. Who's that person in the house? What's happening? Why is there a group of, oh, that's a publicist. Cats, no publicists. They come sometimes with the guests occasionally. I don't let them in the garage, so don't worry. It's still just me one-on-one in here, man. No publicists allowed in the garage. Occasionally, a friend will be in the garage. Occasionally. I interviewed Melissa Etheridge not too long ago, and her wife was in the garage, and that turned out to be very charming. You'll enjoy that when it happens. What was I talking about, though? All right, so we get the urinalysis back, and the doc is like, and this is, they put him on antibiotics again. He'd just been through a 10-day antibiotic, and they make him sick. So I get him back from the vet, and in the day after, you know, he's fucking sick. You know, he's throwing up, he's not eating, he's lethargic. He was just getting his spirit back when I brought him back in because he was licking his dick. He was just getting his moxie back. I think the antibiotics fuck him up. So then, like, you know, now I'm dealing with this sickly cat again. He's not licking his dick. He's not doing nothing. Just sitting on the couch. You know, he's not eating. It makes me scared. He's got undefined inflammation of the bladder. Like, I don't know what, the doc's like, his bladder's really hard and it's inflamed. It's probably a chronic condition. We don't know really what the source of that is. And he's like, bring him back in 2 weeks. We'll take a blood test. Like, do it all now. I'm not one of these people that's sort of like, I don't want to pay for the blood test if we figure, like, just do it all. Now I got to put that poor little fucker back in the cage if he survives 2 weeks. And I had to go out of town. So then I start thinking about it. You know, what is this about? You know, pets die. He's 10 years old, but I thought he'd live longer. And I'm not saying he's going to die. I have a tremendous hope in his ability to survive. But, and that, you know, he's not really ill. He was fine before I brought him to the vet, but I'm just mad. I'm mad. And I started thinking about love, and I started thinking about loss, and I started thinking about, you know, why am I such a panicky fuck? You know, like, why is a full day for me? Like, I don't know what I did today. I don't know, you know, but I know that I had no time to do anything. I know I did some laundry. I know I categorized some records. I know I prepared some food. I know I did some writing for a couple hours. I know I did an interview. I know that that I responded to some emails. I know I swept the kitchen twice. I know I emptied a cat box. I know I fed the cats. I know I washed some dishes and felt bad about washing dishes because there's a water shortage. And then I wondered, can I do a load of laundry? Do I have to put all the load of laundry in now? Should I wash everything at once? Is it on me to save LA from this drought? Kind of is, a little bit. But what about the sprinklers? Do I want my grass to die or should it? Look, it was a full day. What I realize about myself is that there's a lot of activities going on in my brain, then there's actual activities going on in real life. Thank God I'm not just sitting on a couch with just, you know, mental activities, because, you know, then I've been that guy before. Then you're sort of like, man, I've been through a lot today, but I watched some television, but it didn't really stop what I was going through in my head, unfortunately. So I got the mental agenda and I got the actual agenda, and that's a lot of work. And in the mental agenda, I think a lot of it is primarily to keep myself from reacting to, you know, what's really going on. You know, what's really going on is I'm got to write another season of my show. We got to break 13 episodes. We got to break 13 stories, figure out what the themes are. We've started to sort of do that. We're really not on the books until the 27th of this month. So I got all this stuff going on and, you know, my relationships haven't been working out and, you know, I've become cynical about that. I'm afraid to open my heart. My trust is down. So I got my cats. I know I'm a 51-year-old man with two cats, and I know I'm a 51-year-old man that talks about his cats. And I know that in some ways that's very sweet that, you know, he likes his cats, but it's a very, very fine line between sweet and like, oh, that's a little sad already. And I know that. You know? But I love these guys. So I love these cats. And the truth of the matter is, you know, cats don't last forever. People don't last forever. But there's, you know, there's a good chance you're going to outlive your pet unless it's a fucking tortoise or a parrot. Look, I'm not saying monkeys deathly ill. What I'm saying is that I wonder about the idea of loss or change, you know, versus the idea of love. You know, obviously I love these cats, but you take a lot of things for granted. Like, I don't think I'm that much different than a cat in a lot of ways. Like, pretty much a cat just needs the objects to remain relatively where they remember them being. That, from what I understand, you know, a cat sort of gets to know something by, you know, the compartments of their life. Like, okay, that's always there. That's always there. That smells like that. That smells like that. All right. I know where I am. I'm home. I don't know that I'm that different. Like, the idea of like, there's part of me that says, look, you know, I can always get another cat. I can always take care of cats. And again, I don't want to hex anything or jinx anything, but I'm just talking about loss, you know? that I think a lot of my panic, like my brain seeking to get worried and overreact about things, is primarily just to avoid this well of sadness and loss that I will not, I just don't want to deal with. That's why, you know, that's why I've had, you know, like a string of relationships that don't work out. That's why I'm overly obsessed with my cats. That's why I'm categorizing records. You know, that's why I'm moving shelves out for no reason. I'm building things because I just don't want to sit with myself, you know? But it's not, I don't think it's self-pity to sort of, sit down in your midlife, whatever it is. I think that's being optimistic, but maybe a lot of this stuff is just weighing down on me and realize what, not even being nostalgic, just sort of like, there's a lot of people in my life that I miss. There's a lot of relationships that didn't go well. And even if I chose to get out of them, that, you know, there's a sadness to it. There's, you know, there's relationships I have now that I wish were better, you know, and I can do all that stuff. And I feel my ability to do it. Like, I know I can show up for my cat, but then I get frustrated with him. Like, he's obviously not feeling well. He's lethargic. He's not eating. And I go over there and I pet him and I rub his stomach. He's receptive. And I'm like, okay. And then I walk back in the house. He's still on the couch. I'm like, come on. What's going on? And I wouldn't do that to a person that didn't feel well. Again, maybe another reason why perhaps children are not the best thing for me. If I got a kid who's in bed with the flu or something, come day three, I walk in, I'm like, all right, enough already. And oddly, that's what my mother did. So there we go. We're learning things. I guess the message of today's podcast is, I think what I'm going to do, if you don't mind, is try to experience some grief for my losses. Emotionally, it's very specific. Again, I'm not complaining. I'm very grateful to be where I am today, but I have to process some of that stuff. And I think what I'm talking about with the cat is, like, I love that cat, but the idea of not having him around is devastating to me. I know that I'll eventually get over it, but, like, you know, your heart gets heavy. And I know after, you know, we had, you know, Miss Pat on last week and all of you were just blown away by that tale of survival and by the, you know, having a window into a life that many of us don't live. Thank God, but understanding that there's hope and there's humor and there's transcendence, you know, that that what I'm talking about is very minimal. I know that's true, and I know that, like, if I do have gratitude, but I tell you, man, when it comes down to, like, you know, moving a piece of furniture out, I can let that go. Like, maybe that's reminding me of somebody. I don't. But the idea of a cat or a person in my life that just goes away or I push away, it's horrible because it just sticks in your heart for a while. Like, I'm still not over Boomer. I still hope that he comes back. And when Monkey's sick, I get very scared that he won't be around and that I'll have a void as opposed to a solid, lovable little guy. And, I haven't dealt with a lot of that in my life. And whatever. It's not self-pity. It's just a little sadness. It's okay. It's okay. All right? Because he's going to be okay. And I'll be okay. And everything is good. Right? Exactly. You know, I know I have a propensity to be stuck in it. And I'm not going to do it because there's a lot of great things happening. I know a lot of you like the show. And I'm very excited to be working. It's just my cat sick. That's all. It's my cat sick. But you'll enjoy Larry Milmore. Had a good chat with him. Let's do that now. Enough of me talking about my sick cat. Damn it. So I appreciate you have the time.
Is that Jeff Martyr?
That's me, man.
It looks like Martyr, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, Martyr, yeah, it does look like Martyr, actually. Yeah. I had the Martyr hair. And
that look with the glasses.
That is my first headshot.
Wow.
That is my first headshot, and I...
very Martyr-esque.
Well, yeah, I saw him not too long ago. He's all right.
He's a good dude. I haven't seen him in years, but I remember he was so... God, I thought his stand-up was so funny.
He was a Baltimore guy.
Yeah, he was a good
guy. Right?
I think so. Yeah. But I knew him when he was out here.
Well, yeah. I didn't even realize that you were actively stand up
mm-hmm.
for a while.
Long time. That's how I started.
Yeah, I don't know how I missed you. How did I miss you? Why is that? It feels like we were starting...
Well,
where
did you start? On the East Coast?
Yeah, I basically... I was out here in L.A. in the late 80s. I was a doorman at the Comedy Store. Then I went back east to Boston, and then I ended up in New York probably in the late 80s.
Right. See, I started in stand-up in the early 80s and just dabbled a little bit while I was in college. But by 84, I was doing it full-time pretty much. But I was more of a... I'm from here, so I never wanted to do improv or Comedy Store until I felt like I was ready, you know, so I kind of worked an act out on the road.
Well, you know? I mean, so, okay, you grew up in Los Angeles?
Yeah, exactly.
Where?
In Pomona.
I don't even know Pomona. Is that a nice place?
Yeah, it's all right. It was like Orange Groves when I grew up.
So it was.
Yeah, it's down in the suburbs.
Yeah.
It's like the Midwest, basically. And as soon as you go east of Los Angeles, people are like, what?
Oh, I know.
Where is it's either... Where is it, near Kansas? No, it's 30 minutes away.
Looks like Kansas.
Yeah.
You know, you go a little ways outside L.A., you're like, where the fuck am I?
Well, my parents are from the Midwest. They're from Chicago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they moved out here right before I was born. Well,
what brought him out here?
My father wanted to live in Los Angeles because his parents were divorced and his father moved to Pasadena.
And so he was here, your grandfather.
He loved Pasadena.
Uh-huh.
And even though he moved to Pomona, but... And different people have lived in Pasadena at different times. I live in Pasadena now, actually.
You're down the street.
I'm not too far. Yeah, just right around the corner.
Yeah, you are actually.
Yeah,
down the
I think there's a Tommy's Burgers right in between us.
On Colorado.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's all you need to
know.
That's
how I measure things, by where the Tommy's
Burgers
is.
Which side of the Tommy's Burgers or the In-N-Out it is.
Yes, yeah, so on the east side of the Tommy's and the west side of the In-N-Out. Yeah.
So what kind of business was your dad in?
When I was growing up, he was a probation officer. He worked for L.A. County Sheriffs. And then when I was starting college, he went back to school and became a doctor, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's a big-time investment. So he put another six years in?
Yeah, exactly. Went to, got his pre-med stuff. In fact, I went to Mount SAC Junior College. And we have the same name, you know. And I was a theater student, you know, which means, exactly, it means everything that laugh entail, right? So, but my father was serious, you know, he was going back to school. So he was on the dean's list, but, you know, we had the same name. So I'm the third, actually. So people would be like, hey, Larry, man, congrats, you make the dean's list. I'm just like, thanks, man.
So you're at the same school?
Exactly. Because he got some of his pre-med stuff, some of his undergrad stuff, because he was like, got a sociology major when he was first in college.
Uh-huh.
So he had to go back and take all this pre-med stuff.
Oh, for the probation officer stuff.
So exactly. Exactly.
So he wanted to be in the therapeutic community one way or the other.
Yeah, and he ended up staying, working with the county and ended up getting like two pensions or something like that, something ridiculous. He ended up working at L.A. County Jail when O.J. was there. How cool was that?
As a doctor.
Yeah, exactly.
He was like the...
I have to go check up on O.J.
In-house intern. Is that what he was, a general practitioner?
Yeah,
internist?
Pretty much, yeah.
So he was doing the prison thing.
Crazy,
So he had a compulsion to work within, you know, helping prisoners.
I wouldn't use the word helping.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, he cared. But it seems like there's other avenues to go as a doctor.
Yes, but I think it's because he stayed within the L.A. County system.
Oh, not because he's like, these guys need love, too.
No. No.
Not your dad?
No. He's no bedside manner at all, you know. No, it's the complete opposite.
You're from a big family?
Pretty much, six kids, couple of outside kids.
Oh, really?
kind of situation.
Who had those?
My dad, but it was in the transition period, let's call it.
So it was legit. Know. It was off the board.
Exactly, yeah.
So you're...
Right, it's one of those, hey, you can't be mad at that. Come on, man.
We weren't together.
Come on, you can't be mad at that.
But does everyone get along, or...
Oh, yeah, pretty much. I mean, as far as families go.
So wait, so you were, your dad's had two wives?
No, he never got remarried.
Oh.
In fact, my parents got divorced... early 70s, and they had issues like about 4 years before that. They never got divorced. My mom almost kind of, I call it, she fake married a guy. I shouldn't really talk about this, you know.
Yeah.
But it was very bizarre.
Yeah.
But she got close to marrying somebody, but never did. My father never did. And now they spend more time with each other than they ever have.
Really?
Which just freaks all of us out.
Yeah, it's weird how that happens.
It's just not right. Yeah.
But your dad had the other two kids after the divorce.
No. He had one. He had one in that transition period.
Okay.
Yeah.
the transition baby.
Yeah, exactly.
So what, did everyone, are you the only one that ended up in show business?
No, my brother Mark is a writer for The Simpsons.
Right now?
Yeah, and he did stand-up as well, and he wrote for Jay Leno for a long time, wrote on The Tonight Show.
Mark Wilmore?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know him either.
Yeah,
I always think I know all the comics.
We've been hiding in plain sight.
How long has he been writing for The Simpsons?
About 10 years now.
Ooh, so he's doing good.
Yeah, he's
a good racket.
He's a very funny, young man.
Yeah, writing's a good racket, man.
It is a good racket.
It's a lot better than stand-up. At some point, you knew that.
I did. I figured that out.
How'd you figure that out? So
I'll tell you what it was, Mark. Seriously. I mean, it's funny how, like, you say we never crossed paths, but what happens is that, you get on the radar screen for different reasons, you know? And I was the type of comic, I did political comedy, I did... you know, offbeat humor, observational stuff. But as
I watched your tape,
yeah, but I wasn't right. Yeah.
Comic Strip Live.
Really, you saw one of those? But you saw I wasn't your typical urban comic.
No, you were sort of dealing with the sort of highbrow approach to race.
Exactly, you know, which is that became my name and trait now.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah,
but
yeah.
At the time, unless you were the Def Jam type of comic,
you fell through the cracks.
Right, unless you were discussing how brothers are going to gorilla the pussy as opposed to white people just have sex.
Right, you know? Right. But you were more the guy. It's like, let's deconstruct this gorilla
exactly.
the pussy idea.
Why does it have to be gorillas? Why can't it be orangutan?
Right. What?
If the pussy's going to be primated in some way.
Well, why do you think that is? Is that because then, like, you have an unidentifiable audience? I imagine the struggle. That level of doing highbrow race humor as a black comic, it becomes sort of like, well, who am I performing for?
Well, wasn't that quantified in the beginning? I just made people laugh in clubs.
Right.
You know, that's how I viewed it. That was just my sense of humor. But actually, the notion, what it really is Hollywood's notion of what a black comic should be really was what it was about. And Hollywood Shuffle dealt with some of that, too.
Yeah, with that was Townsend's movie. That was the first one. That was like the first real...
commentary on
and
that.
And the indie movie, though. That this big deal was made in the promotion of that movie that he did it by burning through all his credit cards. That he bankrolled the whole movie.
Exactly.
Dom Irrera was in it. Yeah, it was all about that. There was that big Jerry Curl sequence.
Exactly.
Right.
And you have to be Murphy-esque, those types of things. But here's what it was. When I was a kid, I mean, I grew up in the 60s, right? And there wasn't any one notion of a black comic. There were many different types of black comics. You know, you had a Dick Gregory, who's a smart political comic.
Still is.
He still is.
He'd a little conspiracy ridden, but...
Yeah. Now, you know, once he did that Bohemian Diet and all that crap, right?
Yeah.
But he was a political comic. You know, Bill Cosby was a storyteller.
Right.
You know, Flip Wilson was a vaudevillian type comic. He told jokes, old style jokes. Godfrey Cambridge would have been considered a hipster.
Yeah.
You know, he was on the college circuit, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, Red Fox was more of your blue comic. He was a party records, they called him.
Yeah, I got him. I got some of them. Yeah.
Right? Those are great.
He's hilarious.
But there was no one type.
There's Pryor, too.
Yeah, Pryor was an extension of both the Cosby form.
You saw him in that form, and then in the... are you old enough to have seen him?
Absolutely. He started in the Cosby form first, and then he morphed. He took
went to
more,
Berkeley.
Exactly.
Started hanging out with the Panthers, and everything changed.
Exactly. He got some awareness.
A lot of awareness.
Yeah, I'm black!
Yeah. He brought the awareness to everybody.
Exactly. You know.
So that was
notion of one type of black comic.
That's right.
You know, you could fit in any type. Mm-hmm. And then sometime in the 80s, it became one type of thing.
How'd that happen? Was that Def Jam?
I think it started with Richard Pryor, to be honest with you. He was so wildly successful, and Hollywood capitalized on that. You know, and Eddie Murphy was kind of the
next in line.
Part of that id version of Pryor without all the nasty raunchiness.
Right.
I mean, all the messiness of growing up in a whorehouse and that kind of stuff. Here was a nice... middle-class kid, but had the same type of appeal,
So
Murphy was the real glossy Hollywood version of Pryor.
Right. You know? Without the menace. Because
that's true. He was not a threat.
No, but
Murphy
it was interesting.
Not a threat, but Pryor was.
Right, and he was the first threat in that way.
He was a big threat. Mark, I mean, there are some tapes, I don't know if you've seen these, where Pryor is on the set of a movie, and...
With Gene Wilder? Those tapes?
I think it was that.
Was all jacked up?
Exactly. He was on cocaine or something like that. I mean... If you're a movie maker, that's a fucking threat to your ability to finish that film.
Right.
Somebody who doesn't give a fuck about you.
Yeah.
Does not give a fuck about anybody because he gave that up years ago. He knows he's the number one attraction in the world at that time.
Right.
That is a problem.
that's a threat on an executive level for a film executive. But I think culturally.
And culture is like, fuck you, white motherfuckers.
That's right. And that language. But white people were like, oh, yeah, he said fuck us. That was the difference.
Right.
He just said fuck us and we love him.
Exactly.
And so that became the model. If somehow.
And you had to come from a poor background, from the ghetto, that sort of thing.
But it's weird.
You had to speak in that language.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, even the people that took the prior model, which defined what you're saying is the modern black comic,
right.
A lot of them don't cross over.
Correct.
And right. Pryor was the guy that did cross over.
Right.
So how did that, you know, how did that set? Well, I mean, I'm going to ask you questions about,
I know, cultural questions. No, I get asked these a lot because
I understand that model, you know, right. But it's weird that it became isolated, that it became insulated, that what you're talking about, the type right. of comedy you didn't do
correct.
Was based on a model that really facilitated the first real crossover act, which was that's Richard. Right. And then it insulated the rest.
Except for Eddie.
Right. Well, right. Eddie did a lot of things.
Right.
Yeah, a few others.
Right.
But so you did comedy for how long, stand-up?
I did stand-up for about full-time, about 10 years, 10 or 12 years maybe.
And when did you realize that writing was an option?
Well, the reason why I talked about all this was I realized that Hollywood wasn't going to find me, you know, that I had to create my own space, you know. And I realized that if I learned how to write and produce, I could just write something for myself. I mean, I really was inspired by what Townsend and Keenan later did.
Mm-hmm.
And I just decided like around 90, 91 that, I mean, it crystallized itself when I couldn't get an audition for In Living Color, you know. But I ended up writing on that show.
You couldn't get an audition?
No, because I wasn't right for it, you know. You
weren't black enough?
Whatever you want to call it, you know.
But is that along the lines of like?
It's possible. I mean, who knows, you know? But I wasn't the right type. Let's just say,
yeah.
You know.
Okay.
But I mean, I'm not gonna get in people's heads. But for me, I was like, okay, I just need to. I need to define who I am out there,
right?
Myself. I can't try to fit into somebody else's box. I got, and for good or for bad, whether it works or not, I just got to learn how to do that. So I got into writing and producing really to have the. To know how to do that.
So how did you get the job with Keenan on In Living Color?
I just interviewed for it.
But did you give him a package? And...
Yeah, just at that time, I had been working on a show called Into the Night with Rick Dees.
So that was...
But that you was were, my first job.
But were you acting as well?
Yeah. Now, I hadn't quite given up stand-up or performing at that point because I was still making a transition. But once I had decided that I was going to do that, I found out a friend of mine was working on that Rick Dees show, and I sent in some jokes and stuff, and they happened to be looking for a writer, and I got in. So it happened within a couple of weeks of when I decided to do
that. That was the first writing gig.
That was my first
writing
gig.
But the acting, is that what you studied in college?
I studied theater in college, yeah.
But did you go for, what, 4 years and do the whole
thing? I didn't finish. I was at Cal Poly after I did Mount SAC. And
Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo?
No, Cal Poly Pomona.
Oh, okay.
Agricultural Engineering School, which is why I was a theater
Hell of
major.
A theater program, I bet.
It actually was pretty good.
Yeah?
Forrest Whitaker went there for a while.
Oh, really?
We were friends back in the day, yeah.
Are you guys around the same age?
Oh, we were the exact same age, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, we went to, at the time, we did the summer thing together. It's even hard to explain what it was, and that's how I first met him. And he was at Cal Poly, I was at Mount SAC, and then he transferred to SC, and I went to Cal Poly, but we were good friends back then, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, he's an interesting actor.
Yeah.
So you guys are, so you want to be a serious actor?
I did. I studied, I actually was nominated for the Irene Ryan Acting Award when I was in college for doing Oedipus. I mean, so that was the level of seriousness that I had. I studied playwriting, all that kind of stuff. So I was forming that type of background in the beginning. My first professional gig was, I got my Equity card. You know, that was like in 82.
On stage?
At the Mark Taper Forum.
Doing what?
It was their improvisational theater project, and it was, we wrote a play through improvisation. It wasn't the Groundlings type of improv.
No, like
improvisation
heavy
in order
stuff.
Yeah,
right.
to write a play. And theater was, I had a very strong theater background. I worked it in high school and college, you know.
So
I thought I would be a serious actor.
Well, right, but the improvisational theater that isn't identified with comedy is,
right.
It can be pretty heavy.
Absolutely. It started with Stanislavski and, you know, Boleslavski and that whole movement and Adler and Meisner and, you know, that whole...
So you were in. You were a highbrow actor. I wouldn't
say I had that talent, you know, but I certainly had that interest.
Right. You were going to do the real shit.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
So you come to L.A.
But I was interested in comedy, too. I mean, in 79, I did my first audition at the Comedy Store, you know, and I killed...
You were still in college?
I was my first year in college. I just got out of high school. In fact, a couple of years before that, I auditioned for the Gong Show, actually.
Really?
The original
Gong
Show.
Didn't get on as a comic?
No, didn't get on, yeah.
So you had
clearly comedy. I wanted to do that too.
You had it in you.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was like, it sounds like that was the childhood dream.
Definitely.
Based on which comics? The guys you mentioned, which was the first
Flip
comic?
Flip Wilson was the first big one.
Yeah.
He was the first
on the TV show?
He had his own show, Mark. Yeah. I mean, this was a brother on TV who was the funniest person in the world as far as I was concerned.
Right.
I couldn't believe how funny Flip Wilson was.
I mean,
Geraldine was the funniest character, and he had funny people on, and he was always funny, and I just couldn't believe how funny he was.
Yeah.
That and Get Smart, I remember, were the two funniest things. And it's funny because my sense of humor are both of those things kind of combined.
That's the yin and the yang there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that kind of smart, satirical take on the world, and then just bold, just funny.
Yeah, just over-the-top burlesque.
It's completely burlesque. Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
That's hilarious. So did you think that as you got older, like, you know, that, okay, well, so you tried comedy in high school.
Well, yeah, I mean.
And you nailed it?
Not really. I mean, you know, let me put it like this. I've always been in many different compartments.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I always didn't know if it was a schizophrenia issue or just not fitting in. Like, I was a smart kid, so I was in the smart group. But I was also kind of a misfit, so I was in the theater group. You know, and I was also, like, you know, I was really good in sports, too. So I was a jock. You know? I mean, I was really good in sports. I was in a sports neighborhood. Like, three people on our block played pro sports. I mean, that's the level of competition. You know?
Must have been the weird. The jocks must have not known what to do with you.
It was huge, you know. But here's the other thing. Because you had people of that caliber, you knew very early on whether you had what it took.
Sure, for sports.
You're like, I'm not 6'6". I'm not that size. I'm not going to play pro basketball.
Yeah.
I mean, there were no false illusions.
Right.
So, and that was a good thing, actually. So, like, in my first year in college, you know, I had to make a hard decision I mean, I was really good in that time in basketball. I could have played probably at some colleges.
Yeah.
But you know, I had gone to school with Bill Duffy, who played, you know, he was an All-American in the same year as Magic Johnson.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, I'm not at that level.
It's hard. My brother was a tennis player. That moment where you realize that I just don't have the genetics or the physicality for it, the gift.
90% genetics.
Right.
90% genetics.
Right. I mean, you could be a good player and just say, like, well, I can enjoy this on my own time.
Exactly.
I don't have to destroy my life chasing this dream.
Mark, biggest lesson of my life, and one that when I talk to kids, I say, you don't have to do for a living what your passion and dream is.
That's right.
You can just have a job and keep that as your hobby keep enjoying it.
Why ruin it?
Exactly. Because I'm actually I'm a sleight of hand magician.
Oh, that, you know? Too, huh?
But I do that in my spare time. Never wanted to be, it was my first real love and passion, you know. Never wanted to do it for a living. Always wanted to keep it in a box. And it's still there, you know.
There's a big drop off between pro ball player and sleight of hand.
Exactly. That was the old joke. What's the difference between a pizza and a magician? A pizza can feed a family of five.
But you still enjoy doing both.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know.
All right. So you do the acting thing, and you're doing heavy shit. You're doing Oedipus, and you're doing Artie
Shakespeare,
theater.
All that stuff, right?
And when did you realize, like, that ain't going to be the thing?
Well, it was never that so much.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was, I didn't compartmentalize that. It was, showbiz was one whole thing. It was showbiz or not showbiz, as opposed to this part of showbiz or this part of showbiz.
Right.
When I made the decision, because I dropped out of school to join the Tapers thing full time and to do stand up. And I thought, I'm just going to dedicate myself to it. Because I had tried it a few years earlier and I got kind of scared, you know. I mean, that was the Comedy Store's heyday when I was going up an open mic night. I mean, people like, you know.
What year?
This was 80, you know, so.
Right, so it was after the original heyday with Richard and everybody and when the comedy business
was
blowing
up. This is
when
people like Letterman were going up regularly, like emceeing in the main room.
Maybe Jim Carrey was there almost.
Jim Carrey was just about to break
right.
out. But that was in his early days and people were like, who is this guy?
Right.
People like Howie Mandel were huge in the Comedy Store that time. Those are the big people.
Jay was
big time.
Jimmy Walker.
Big time. Well, Jimmy, not so much because he was already a star.
Yeah, he
was gone by that time. But Jim J. Bullock, I remember, was one of the big guys.
Yeah.
Alan Stevens was a big Comedy Store guy. Remember
him.
Alan?
Yeah. I interviewed him. He's still.
Carol Leifer, she was on East Coast, but I remember people like that. Yeah, so it was very intimidating.
And was Richard coming in as well?
Richard would come in and work on stuff.
Yeah.
And so I remember seeing him there in the original room.
It's mind-blowing, right?
Isn't that fucking amazing?
To see him in the original room?
I remember
room?
Standing in the back. Just
like, what?
And I would I would sneak in because I was too young to be there, you know.
Right, but you were a comic. You
Right. Trying to do it, you know.
So the door guy let you in and, you
know. Yeah, that kind of thing. You're sneaking through the back. Somebody let you
First time I saw him there, I mean, I was there in 87.
Yeah.
And he had already been on fire and everything else. And it was a little bit heartbreaking. Yeah. But to see him around 80 when he was still like.
No, it was amazing, Mark. And to sit back in the original room, because, you know, Paul Mooney would go up and do all the nigga stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And it was funny, but it wasn't Richard. And when Richard would go up, even when he, and to see him work on stuff that hadn't been, you know, it's not a bit yet.
Laid back.
Exactly. And he's just working
very
on it.
Deliberate.
Ugh.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Mooney was always this, you know, this bombastic thing.
Exactly.
That, oh, fuck you. No. Because a nigga's on stage.
Every comeback to the.
He's already defensive and no one's done anything yet.
Before he even starts his act, he's walking up going, this nigga's not going to get a laugh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's weird. I middled for him once in Sacramento. And like I used to watch him when I was a doorman at the store for a while, and just I never quite got it because it didn't. You know, I never quite understood the point.
Right.
You know, like I understood the sentiment and the anger, and that obviously exists, but I never understood what made Mooney so great. So I'm middling for Mooney, and I don't know how he's gonna do, and I'm just doing my time, and he wanted me to. You get into that thing with Mooney. You know, he had a guy traveling with him, and he had one of the kids with him, a younger kid. And he's like, "Do you want to take the kid to the mall?" And he's like, "No, I don't." Yeah, but like, here's the weird thing: is that if the thing I found out about Mooney is that if you're a white person, and you don't think you're racist. He'll find it in you.
Absolutely.
Is that the and the approach is? You know, I would sit there, and he'd be going on 2 hours.
Right.
You know,
That's hilarious.
And like at some point, some white guy's gonna go, "When is this guy? When is he gonna shut the fuck up?" You know what I mean? Like he's gonna test
your
patience.
He's just waiting for it, right? Right.
Test your patience.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
It's kind of brilliant.
Oh, I think Mooney is brilliant.
No, he's definitely
brilliant. One of those geniuses that's why it's hard for people like that to be mainstream. Because part of their appeal is that they are so individual and unique. You know?
But he also set a precedent for a lot of black comics, for a lot of comics in general, that you know, there was a courage there and a persistence that is a unique and it's a courageous thing.
And a lot of people adopted that, but without the wit.
That's right. You know, and he would always do that late spot. You know,
always.
Kennison would sit there and watch him. Everybody would sit and watch him.
Always, yep.
So, all right, so now you're going to be a comic. And another question I had, though, like because you do put yourself in the position to sort of address race almost constantly.
Right.
What when you were in high school, when you're doing, you know, moving through all those different things, you know, being a jock, being a theater guy, being a good student, how did people assess you as a black person?
Well, I went to basically an all white school.
Right.
Me and my friend were the only blacks in our senior class. I remember.
Really?
It was a Catholic school. And I always felt. Part of how I always felt kind of growing up, I felt like I was at a family reunion and I wasn't in the family, right?
Yeah.
So it's that. So you always felt like an outsider in a way. And I don't know. At the time, I didn't think about that too much. They were just things that I was interested in. But I would do things like I'd run for student office and I'd always win because I'd have the funniest speech.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And people always called me Wilmore. No one ever called me Larry. I was always called by my last name. But I never really felt like a part of that group except with my buddy. And, you know, we used to make the jokes about all that stuff and everything.
Because, you know, I've talked to black guys who, you know, if they were, there's that idea or probably the reality of being judged by the black community as somebody who is playing the white man's game or
no, it wasn't so much that. I mean, kids would make fun of us because we were in Catholic school. We'd be walking home, oh, you go to that Catholic school.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because we have uniforms.
Right, right.
And that kind of stuff. But I didn't worry about that too much because we were more the representatives at our school. That was our identity more than somebody looking at us as a certain thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, we were keeping it real.
Right,
that's
what
we were there to do.
Right, you know? You were representing black people at your school.
Exactly. We were representing black.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, no, motherfuckers, this is us right here. So that was our point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
And remember, I grew up in the 60s, black power, black identity, that sort of thing. And I lived through, I don't remember when Malcolm X was killed, but I remember Martin Luther King was killed.
You do? How old are you?
I'm 52. I'll be 53 in October.
I'm 50. Yeah.
I was born in 61. But I remember that. I remember my mother just inconsolable. And so I remember those moments. And so I had a strong identity of what that meant.
Uh-huh.
You know, like I tell people, I'm not a researcher. I'm a witness. You
right.
know?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So
now you get into comedy and you're going full time. So who are the guys around, you know, that you're running with? in 80, 81, 82?
Well, 81, 82, I was still in school. I didn't start stand-up full-time until about 84.
Yeah.
And so I started out at the Laugh Stop in Newport Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people that would come through there were kind of like George Lopez was somebody I started with. We used to do the open mic nights all the time. People like, I don't remember if you remember Steve Odekirk.
Yeah, sure. He did all those weird noises and the
he
plane,
lived out there. And we used
the
to,
plane thing.
Yeah, all of that stuff. Yeah. He was a big Comedy Store guy for a while.
Yeah, I used to see him when I was a doorman.
Howard Trespin, I think, used to book the Laugh Stops, and he gave me some of my first road gigs. But at the same time, I still was acting and that kind of stuff. I had like a small part in the Facts of Life. I got a recurring role. And
that's a big deal.
Yeah, it was huge at the time. But what's hilarious is that as I was starting out in stand-up, that was my credit.
You know?
that credit would
facts
open
of life.
You may have seen him on the Facts of Life. Facts of Life. Because whenever you travel somewhere, the fact that you were from L.A. was a credit in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's from Los Angeles. You'd be like, Los Angeles.
Real show business.
Well, yeah.
So you do the 10 years there.
Right.
Now, how you grew up Catholic is, that's interesting to me.
Unending source of material.
Yeah.
But see, there were a lot of black Catholics, Washington, D.C. area, Chicago area. There's a lot of different areas in the country where black Catholics kind of congregated. So my family is one of those.
From Chicago.
Yeah.
So it goes back.
On my father's side.
A few generations
absolutely.
Of Catholic.
Yeah.
An interesting choice. Someone made the choice at some point.
But it is funny, though. But now when I look at it, it's funny. I don't have that black Baptist Southern church tradition.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in my comedy. I'm not a preacher in my stand-up and that kind of thing. I've always been more laid back, dry in that because that's more
Catholic. It's interesting,
right?
You were denied the screaming background.
Exactly. For silent suffering. Right.
There's no fainting or witnessing.
Exactly. So I've always had more in common with the Jewish sense of humor brand than with the traditional black preacher comedy brand.
Sure, which was predominant.
Yeah, like my heroes are Groucho, you know.
Right.
Kind of wit. That
it made
snappy
more sense.
Wit. Yeah, I mean, that always appealed to me. You know, it still does, that type of thing. You know?
Well, that's interesting because, like, you know, Pryor was all about, you know, screaming and, you know, and the preacher.
Pryor
and, you know,
was hilarious. And
but Cosby, not so much. Cosby was almost strictly family. You didn't get any sense of that. That type of...
You know what's funny? Cosby was not one of my favorites growing up.
Yeah.
And that sounds heretical.
Right.
But,
But
my tastes were like, even though Cosby was funny, like what really made me... Like I was more intrigued by even Bob Newhart.
Sure.
You know, because there was something clever behind it. There was something more than just funny. He was taking an idea that Abraham Lincoln idea... And it was that was a funny, clever take on that of
the Gettysburg Address thing,
where he's coaching him, you know, his press agent or whatever. You
sure,
know?
That's like that's almost like a Lenny Bruce riff of the Hitler thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I loved impressions too. I did impressions.
So you're more
that kind of stuff too.
More like you liked people that had something put together.
Yeah,
like
exactly. So Cosby, I thought was funny, but I never sought him out as That's what I like. That's why I like Get Smart. It was satirical. It was making a comment.
And it was about beats.
You know,
I mean, Cosby was about, you know, feeling and about movement.
Right.
You know, and obviously he has beats.
Right.
But like stuff like that's written. You know, Mel Brooks with Get Smart.
Right.
That they're and Newhart as well. That
right.
You know, these were structured jokes.
Exactly. Like Steve Martin, I could not get enough of Steve Martin when he came on the scene because there was thinking behind that persona, and you could see the thinking behind it. You know,
it wasn't just my family.
Exactly. People thought it was an arrow through the head that was the joke. No. It was the fact that he put the arrow in his head.
Yeah.
And I remember he did something on The Tonight Show where he had like dogs where he was performing to the dogs. Who would do something like this? That kind of outrageousness. Like, I love Monty Python.
Yeah. The balls of absurdity.
Yeah. Python were comedy gods to me.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
That type of thing more than. Like straight improv or that sort of thing.
So here you are, you're writing, you've been given entree into the writer's room of what was a very important thing for television.
Absolutely.
That this was, you know, the first black sketch show.
It's huge.
That it was phenomenal.
Right.
And, you know, what'd you learn there? What was the feeling there? That, you know,
well, in Living Color, man, that was a show. To me, it was the show that really introduced hip hop to the television culture.
Uh-huh.
So it was more than a black thing. It introduced the hip-hop culture with the clothing and the music, the language, the style of humor. That and Arsenio did it, you know, in a huge way, which is... And before, no one had really, this culture hadn't really been on television. It had been in videos and that kind of stuff, but not on television, you know.
It was one dimensional.
Yeah.
And previous.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
If anything, you know, or yeah. people just didn't really know what it was.
What are they doing?
I know. Right?
Yeah. Like, that was a reaction. Like, they're, I don't.
Why don't they pull their pants up? What's going on?
Yeah.
Even, so that was, it was the, I always tell people it was the worst of times of the worst of times from a writer's point of view, only because it was so difficult. But you learned everything.
In what way?
Well, someone got fired every week on that show.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was, Keenan was very demanding. The writer's room was very challenging. But it was the smartest people I'd ever been around who were funny, too, you know. To see Damon and Jim Carrey at the top of their game.
Damon's amazing.
Damon was fucking amazing.
I used to see him at the Comedy Store. I was like, I used to say, what are you going to do tonight? You going to do your set? You going to do your act? And he's like, no, I think we're going to do the jazz set today.
That's hilarious. Yeah, yeah. But he could do that then because they loved him so much.
Yeah. Well, he'd go out there, too. I mean, with characters, and he'd just push it, man.
Yeah, he was amazing.
Yep.
To be up close to it was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. that was
everybody involved in the writing?
A little bit. Jim Carrey used to come to the offices. I used to write with Jamie Foxx sometimes. He would come around. Sometimes David Alan Greer. For the most part, not that much. Of course, Keenan ran the show, so he was involved all the time.
How's he doing, Keenan? You in touch with him?
Keenan's always been doing great. I see him now and then. And, I mean, Keenan is a mogul. You know?
Yeah, well, I used to get very...
Keenan figured it out.
Yeah, it was very interesting to me because I saw him... Because I was at the store in 86, so you know, he'd already done Living Color, but he would still show up and do comedy very rarely, but occasionally.
Yeah.
And it always sort of fascinated me, the different, because like, you know, he's more like you stand up.
Right.
And Damon's his other thing.
Absolutely.
You know, it was like night and day, man. You're
absolutely right. Keenan, my stand up was very close to what Keenan was doing back then too.
Yeah.
So there were really, it's funny, Keenan had to create that show to create a space for himself.
Right.
You know, that space was not there.
And let go of the stand up.
Exactly. He had a different, his role as host, you know, of that show and bringing that was more important than him doing an hour stand-up special.
Right.
That was Damon's, you know, Damon could even have that space, you know, but not Keenan.
So you were on Living Color for the whole run?
No, I was just there for a couple of years. I came on in the third season and did a couple of seasons, and then I started in sitcoms after that.
Just doing, so you learned the ropes at Living Color.
I learned everything about how to keep a job. I mean, you have to pitch so much. By the time I got to sitcoms, it was easy, you know, because you had to pitch every day at In Living Color, you know.
To bits.
Yeah, and it was like, so you had to come up with unique ideas all the time. And on a sitcom, you have a group of characters and scenarios. You don't have to invent that every week. You're just inventing new scenarios.
Right.
In Living Color, you had to think of new characters all the time, new bits, new ideas based on pop culture, on the news, on this, on that. So your brain was maxed all the time trying to think of this.
So a sitcom is just refillable in a way.
Easy.
So what'd you go to from there?
I did a show called Sister Sister. It was my first show.
Who was in that?
Tia and Tamara Mowry.
Did that last a while?
The twins. It was on for a few years. It was on ABC and then the WB. But they're big reality stars now. They've been around for a while. They have.
And you were just staff writer?
Started as a story editor. Moved up the ranks pretty quick on that.
Yeah. And then what happens?
Then I did a few shows when I was on Fresh Prince for a while. I did a show called The Show. And then...
The Show with Sam Cedar?
Yeah, Sam Cedar. That's right. Yeah. That was before he became a pundit.
No, I work with Sam Cedar.
Yeah.
I was, we did a streaming video show. He's a friend of mine.
Oh, Sam was awesome. He was great on that. We were
on Air America. I thought it was a good idea.
It was a very good idea. And here's a great story about that. So John Bowman, who created it, he worked on Martin and on In Living Color.
Yeah.
You know? So he had this crazy character on the show, and he was trying to cast it. And he found this guy who was perfect for it. He was out of New York, and Fox did not like him. But the Fox executive at the time, who I don't even know he's even in the business anymore, thought he was too ugly. He wasn't good looking enough. So so John's so frustrated because he knows this guy is perfect for it. So they made him keep looking for someone. And eventually the holding deal expired for this guy, you know, and he still hadn't found anyone. And so then in frustration, he said, look, I have to, let me just hire this guy, you know. I can't find anybody. They said, okay, you can hire him. So he went back to him and asked if he'd do the show. He says, all right, fine, but I'll only do the pilot now. I won't do the series because I guess his feelings were hurt or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And he says, okay, great. And so he did the pilot and he killed. He was the funniest thing on the show.
Yeah.
Funniest thing on the show.
Yeah.
And then after the pilot, he was like, Sorry.
About.
Peace. And that guy was Paul Giamatti.
Really?
Paul Giamatti. He was hilarious. And he didn't do the series. He stuck to his word. And Fox could have had him on a series. And the show was never the same without him. Never the same.
What was he? Was one of the writers on the show?
Yeah, he played one of the white writers.
Right.
He was hilarious.
Oh, my
ask Sam.
God.
Ask Sam. He'll tell you how frustrating that was. We could not replace
Sam's
him.
Sam's whole experience with TV was frustrating. The number of opportunities he had, and either blew on purpose or not on purpose, was fascinating.
I thought he was good in that part, though.
No, he's very funny.
He did a good job.
And I thought the premise was great.
Yeah, it was. It's just, you know, sometimes it's timing with TV shows.
Yeah.
Sometimes it just comes on at the wrong time, just doesn't quite. I do it.
So
out of that, I decided I wanted to be a showrunner. I wanted to do my own thing. I had worked on the Jamie Foxx show after that, I think. And I ended up getting a deal with Disney, an overall deal to develop shows. I had done a pilot with a couple of guys from The Simpsons, but it didn't go. And I was contacted by someone at Imagine, about that Eddie Murphy wanted to do an animated show.
Uh-huh.
And so I met with them, and it turned into the PJs.
That became
that was the first show that I was able to.
That was successful.
Yeah, it did pretty well. Mm-hmm. It has like a cult status now, which is kind of cool.
Did you work with Eddie directly?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So you guys are okay?
Oh yeah, we just talked a few days ago. He wants to do a movie now. Yeah.
Oh really?
Yeah, Eddie was cool during that process, man. He was very cool. And here's the thing, Mark: until you actually work with Eddie, you don't appreciate how funny he is.
Well, I appreciate how funny he is, but you know, it's like I think
it's because of the movies he's done. It's kind of,
but also just because of, like, when someone reaches a certain level of celebrity, everyone makes assumptions and it becomes a mysterious character. But you know, people who know him, it's like, he's just a guy, you know, with a lot of fucking money.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. But he's still just a dude.
No, he's hilarious.
Yeah, no, he's always hilarious. So you did that with him, and then what happens?
After that, I created the Bernie Mac show.
Now, Bernie, that he was something else, man.
Bernie was a huge talent.
I tell you, man, it's like back in 95.
Did you ever work with Bernie?
Here's the weird thing. Mm-hmm. I met him like I was at the Aspen Comedy Festival.
Right.
And I don't think the show had been on yet. So they decided they're going to have a black showcase up there.
Right.
So it's Bernie.
Wait, this is 95?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, this is way before I worked with him.
Yeah, right. So it was Cedric and Bernie, and I can't remember the other guys. Right. And just, they're the only five black dudes in Aspen ever.
Right, exactly.
They're walking around going like, what the fuck are we doing?
That's
hilarious. Can't breathe up there. But, and Bernie, you know, back then, I mean, was bringing a version of the black experience that was so uniquely,
right?
Like, it was so insular.
I ain't afraid of you, motherfucker.
Yeah. Like, it was like, you know, this is the real deal. It was almost like you're like, we're not even supposed to be seeing this.
No, that's called keeping it 100. That's what that's called, Mark.
Right. And it was mind blowing to me because, like, he was so huge. And it always pisses me off that there is a strange detachment between the comedy communities. They're like, I feel like for some reason, and I've been criticized on some level, it's like, because I'm like, I don't have a lot of black acts on the show because I don't see them around.
Right.
You know, and they're like, well, then
a lot
go.
Of it is in different worlds.
That's right.
Right.
And it's annoying, but I understand it.
Right.
You know, it's not like imposed. It's a decision. Your market's your market.
Right.
And there's guys who are like, well, I want to do both markets. And then and there are other guys who are like, fuck that.
Right.
I'm okay.
Well, and you go to where your audience is.
That's right.
Right. To me, the whole thing about things being separated, I always had an issue with, because, like I said, when I grew up, it wasn't like that. Like, you know, even the way TV kind of segregated itself to having, you know, what I call Nig at Night, you know, when all the black shows have to be on one night, you know, and that kind of thing. You know, I'm like, why is that? You know, I mean, the Jeffersons.
Someone somewhere is saying, we know where they all are right now.
Yeah, exactly.
They're all watching tonight.
Yes, it's like the back page of Jet magazine. It would tell you where all the black people were that week. It was like if the police ever needed to know, you know, this is where the black people are in showbiz, you know.
What's all it all becomes, you know, indicating of something dubious,
right?
You know, but not as necessarily as profoundly intentional as some people would suggest, but definitely institutionalized,
right?
Yeah. Mm. So, all right. So, working with Bernie though, that must have been mind blowing. You co-created that thing, and that was a big show.
I created it. I didn't co-create it.
You were the guy.
Yeah. So I always have to make that distinction. No, I did create that show. Yeah. In fact, I won an Emmy for the pilot script.
Then that's amazing. And it went the full ride, right?
It went about five seasons. Fox fired me after the second season.
Didn't matter. You created it.
Yeah, exactly. We never got along with the head of Fox at the time, who was another guy who's now out of showbiz.
What happened with that? What was the issue?
He was just out of his mind. He was just, you know, he was a real control freak and had a real horrible attitude. But at the time, I had deconstructed the sitcom in order to write Bernie. I mean, remember, I have a theater background. You know, I studied, you know, Ibsen and Shakespeare and all that stuff. So I had a strong writing background and all that stuff. And at the time, every sitcom was kind of the multi-camera,
right?
You know, which is really based in farce and kind of based in burlesque almost, you know, and it's a filmed version of almost a burlesque show in some ways, you know.
Vaudeville, anyway.
Yeah, vaudeville, all that kind of stuff, you know, which is great. It's a great form, but it's based on something different. And I was taking a cue from the reality world when I created Bernie. I said, there's something different going on here. The act breaks are different and all that kind of stuff. So I had to construct it in a different way. And it was single camera. You know? The only other single camera in the show was Malcolm in the Middle at the time. And so based on that, they would give me notes on this other thing, and I was trying to write something different. So we always had a conflict.
Right.
And they called me incompetent and thought I didn't know what I was doing. Meanwhile, I kept winning awards. We won a Peabody, Humanitas, Emmy, you know, TV Critics Award. And that made them more angry. Like,
so they were trying to do the old paradigm, which was three camera, and give you notes on what they thought it should be?
Well, they were giving me notes based on that.
Yeah.
And acting as if I was the dumb one.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Whereas I had deconstructed all that and was doing something different.
Yeah, and it started with the monologue and the
yeah,
voice.
Talking to the camera. Yeah. And, you know, and some of that's taken from old cues, even from the old George Burns, Jack Benny, and as recently as Gary Shandling doing that kind of stuff. But in a different way, making a different experience.
And now you're the guy running it, so you got to hire writers.
Exactly.
And you're running the room.
Right.
What do you look for in a TV writer, man?
What do I look for?
Yeah.
It really depends on the project, to be honest with you. Because I've worked on so many different shows.
Yeah.
Like at the moment, I'm doing a show for ABC,
yeah,
the sitcom, but then I'm also going to be doing my own late night show.
Right. You're taking over for Colbert's spot.
Right.
What's that going to be called?
The Minority Report with Larry Wilmore.
You decided that. That's the name.
That is the name.
And
right.
Who's producing that? John?
John, yeah. And myself.
Uh-huh.
And his Busboy Productions. But hiring writers for that is a complete different experience than hiring writers for a half-hour sitcom.
Right.
So in half-hour, you're looking for, depending on what type of show, also makes it more specific.
See what their pedigree is.
Yeah, and their storytelling ability.
Right.
You know, how funny they are on the page, their ability with characters, all kinds of different issues. Whereas late night, it's a little narrower.
Maybe
it's just how funny are they, how insightful are they with taking a topic.
Yeah, because it's a different context. You're
exactly.
Dealing with
they don't
with
have to
news.
Tell a story.
Yeah, you're dealing with commentary.
Exactly.
And not story.
Exactly.
So
if it was the Tonight Show, it'd be more monologue-based.
Right, right.
You know,
I get it.
Or bit-based. So it depends what kind of show you're running or what you look for in a writer.
And you also did The Office. You worked on The Office as well.
Right. I was a producer on the show, writer. And
now,
and
The Office is notoriously kind of like known for being sort of a... You know, is a repository the right word for Harvard alum?
Right.
You know, but, you know, there's this idea.
Right.
And I know you've commented about it publicly, I think, a bit.
Yeah, I think, yeah. The way that I talked about it, almost, it's a little unfair what I think what I was saying in that respect. I was making a different comment and I kind of used the Harvard alums as an unfair punching bag.
It's always a fair punching bag.
Right, exactly. But, oh, but go ahead. What was your
question? I mean, there is really no easy way. It just seems to me that anybody who thinks that anybody got anything easy in show business, if they can't do the job, they won't have
correct.
The job.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
Like, there's this idea. It's like,
unfortunately, some glaring exceptions.
Yeah.
Right.
Like?
Some people that are running networks, some people that...
I'm not talking about networks. Right. Let's keep it on the creative. Network executives are a whole other breed.
Yeah, you know? Some people get into, you know, they get to fail forward sometimes. And
right. But,
and
but
there are some examples of those in the writing world, yes.
Oh, okay. Definitely. Okay. All right. And if I can tell by your face that you know exactly who you're
exactly.
talking about.
I know a few people like that, right?
Are they Harvard people?
No, they are not Harvard people.
Well, you
got
to figure the Harvard people know how to work.
Yeah, you know what?
You can't sweep through Harvard, really.
No, and I think a lot of your Harvard people really, I mean, they're smart. That's why they went to Harvard, you know?
Sure.
So, you know, you're starting with that. And
yeah, and it's all, you know, if you know what you want to do and that's how you're going to do it, I mean, it's the way it is. All right, so let's talk about this amazing opportunity. You've obviously done literally hundreds of panel pieces with John.
Mm-hmm.
You defined your tone. You know, this is like, it seems to be, you know, that experience on The Daily Show was a very specific re-entry into performing.
Correct.
that, you know, utilizes stand-up chops and commentary
right.
chops.
Absolutely
and,
right.
So yeah. when the gig came, how did it, like, just for my own knowledge, mm-hmm. how did the desk pieces start? How did you get it with John?
Well, you're right. It was my re-entry. I was, you know, I had been show running and writing and that kind of stuff. And after getting fired from Fox, I realized now was the time to get back into performing.
Well, you had some passive income as well. I mean, with Bernie running, you're the creator.
Well, sure. I mean, from a comfortable standpoint,
right.
you know.
Right.
But, you know, certainly when you're at a crossroads, that's not the issue.
Yeah, it's money's like, not the issue.
Yeah, it's like, what do you really want to do with your life?
I'm in
what
my 40s. Is it over?
It's never over, Mark.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had to say, look, am I going to do this or not? You know, am I going to... This was the whole reason why I was writing, was so I could do something for myself. Mm-hmm. Now's the time to start doing that. Mm-hmm. So I had to come up with a plan of how I wanted to attack that. One of the plans was to write a show for myself and be in it. The other plan was to get back to my stand-up comedy roots mm-hmm. and do like the talk show type of thing. Mm-hmm. But I knew I had been separated from an audience for so long, I had to get back in touch with an audience.
Get your chops.
Exactly. And find out even if I'm even still funny in that
yeah.
in that way.
Yeah.
Because you never know. Sometimes the audience moves on and you don't line up.
Yeah.
Like I always say, people, it's not that they stop being funny, it's that they line up with what the audience considers
yeah,
to
I know,
be funny.
But you're not like the guy right. who wore the hat.
Yeah, right, exactly. You know,
there was no identifying thing like, oh, the guy with the hat's back. I think that hat's
right.
out.
Luckily, I never got famous enough to be dismissed by the audience.
That's right.
Right. I was always under the radar, you
right,
know. So
right.
that turned out to be a good thing for me,
right.
actually. So I was able to kind of splash on the scene with all this experience. You know, in front of people, and they didn't even realize I was in front of them the whole time, you know, which is kind of cool.
That is cool.
But
the guy behind the scenes.
I know.
The wizard.
I mean, and I had done all these stand-up shows,
sure.
but nobody remembered that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I won a couple of Star Searches back in the day. Nobody remembered that crap. You
right.
know?
So, you went through the whole Star Search process?
Oh, yeah, and the original one, yeah, uh-huh. all that stuff, you know. I lost to Michael Collier. He was like that, the homeless comic at the time.
I remember
he was selling
him.
All that
sure,
crap.
Sure, man.
That was so funny. And I was doing all this, it's just, you know.
The intelligent stuff, and he was doing like, exactly. what are you all doing?
Exactly.
Moving around. He was trying to pull a crowd in with a hat when he was doing a theater. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, I'm doing jokes like, you know, if I was a beer, you know, a lot of people ask me what I mix with. You
yeah,
know, I
yeah.
say, look, if I was a beer, I'd be a Negro Light. And I'm a third less angry than the regular
yeah,
Negro.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah, yeah.
Which was always a good joke, but
sure.
it's not that joke. It's not the other
well,
joke.
Well, you know who else reminded yeah, me of you yeah. that I thought was a great comic, but in the exact same vein was John Ridley.
Oh, I love Ridley. He's a good friend, yeah.
He's great.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk to him. I tried to get him yeah. on here because I remember his jokes.
Yeah.
I remember the joke about...
He doesn't even remember his jokes, by the way.
The Uptown Cigarette joke is, right. like, to me, one of the perfect jokes about
uh-huh.
race. Where remember, Uptown Cigarette was the cigarette yeah. that came out, was manufactured to appeal to black people.
Right.
And his joke was, like, I would have liked to have been at that business meeting at the cigarette company.
Right.
Where he goes, well, Bill, I can't help but notice there's still a lot of black people around.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Ridley's very smart. He's yeah. one of those. He's one of those true intellectuals.
Yep, yep. Well, he does some, you know, great, you know, movie writing, and you know, he's
doing sure. American Crime show at ABC right now. Then,
yeah,
he wrote and directed.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. just like, but you know, he was in that area that you're talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah,
the sort of not the you know not the the common
right.
you
not,
know,
not
black
the typical
act.
What was yeah. being sold at the time.
All right, so right. John, how you pitch John? What happens there?
So I go and interview with The Daily Show. We thought it would be a good thing to do, possibly. And my managers at the time had a client who was a writer on the show, so that's how I got the meeting. And I think we pretty much talked about sports. I don't even remember talking about what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And John said, yeah, it sounds cool. Why don't we try it out? And they were changing over the show at the time. Colbert had left the year before. Cordry was just leaving. They just hired John Oliver, Rob Riggle. I think Asa Mambi was just starting. So a lot of people were moving out and people were coming in. And John wanted to, you know, open up the show a little bit. And so my first bit on The Daily Show, I remember, you know, when you're first writing it, you have Colbert and Carell in your head. And they did it the best. They're that fake newsman.
Yeah,
so
sure.
you don't know what your voice is yet.
Yeah.
I'm trying to write something and wasn't sure what it was. And DJ Jabberbaum, Steve Bodo, two of the writers, came up with the idea of the senior black correspondent, which was a funny joke. You know?
Yeah.
And that's all I really had. And I remember the first bit during the rehearsal, it really didn't go over well because, you know, you like it's all those problems with voice and everything. Not
yeah.
that the jokes weren't funny.
Right.
Just not comfortable with the voice. And I remember, like, the crew and stuff, they're not wanting to look at you, you know. You know, it's that
they don't know how you're long you're going to be
exactly.
around.
Exactly. It's like you don't name your farm animals because you might eat them.
That's right.
You know, some of the, you know, you don't want to get too close to them, right?
Right, right.
It's that kind of thing. Yeah. Exactly. So I remember being very nervous. I'm, fuck, man, this is going to be my first and only shot at this. I'm going to be gone, like, right after this. And we were going to do two. And after we rehearsed both of them, they both died. They said, somebody came to me and said, Larry, John said we're just going to do one. And he wants to see you in a few minutes. We're just going to go through some rewriting. And I thought he wanted to see me to tell me it's not going to work out.
You know?
But I went in and John was very nice. And the process is right before air, John goes through it with you line by line.
Right.
And he just had me kind of put it in my own voice and we kind of talked it through. So it wasn't so stilty,
right.
So stilted, you know.
So he can interact like a natural way.
Yeah, it became more natural.
Right.
The same jokes were there, but it became more of a conversation.
Make it a conversation, yeah.
And that helped me a lot, especially with my acting background, right? Acting and stand-up.
Yeah.
And then right before we went on the air, John did the best thing he could do, especially for a stand-up. He just looked at me and said, Larry, look, just look in the camera and just fucking give it to America.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay. And my first joke killed, right?
Yeah.
And so now my stand-up comedy...
Yeah,
you
I'm
know,
in.
And I'm like, all right, motherfuckers, you shouldn't have laughed. Now, now I'm reeling them in. And now the crew's like, who's this motherfucker? You know, did they switch guys? You know,
yeah.
And it was the best feeling in the world.
Yeah, and that's what started it all.
It just all connected on that first one, and we just took off from there.
And yeah, the dynamic is great, and you know, John's a great straight man.
Really is.
Yeah,
he's underrated as that.
No, yeah, well, he's very good at it.
He's unbelievable at it. And like Johnny Carson, he lets you be funny.
Yeah.
You know, he just lets that happen.
Yeah.
And he's happy to
to
be, you know, around it.
That's true. John does not get enough credit for that.
He really doesn't.
And it is a big part of his job.
Because people focus on the other part of it, which is good, the Walter Cronkite part.
Sure. Yeah.
He's the Johnny Carson and Walter Cronkite.
That's right. It's a very true thing that you're saying. Because so much of that job is him, you know, providing a space for
others. Look at the careers he's launched.
That's right.
Yeah.
So let's just talk quickly about the new show. So it's going to be the Minority Report. Is it going to be somewhat structured like your Showtime special, or how are you going to do it?
Thanks for mentioning that, Ben.
Yeah.
Not quite. I think it'll, you know, we haven't worked out the specifics yet.
Uh-huh.
I'll start working on it in October. But the main thing, I mean, there'll probably be a beginning where I'm weighing in on some of the issues of the day. Kind of in a Daily Show way, possibly. But I think the main part of the show is going to be a real conversation with funny people, but not a scripted thing.
A panel.
Yeah. And I want to get people who are funny conversationalists more than setting somebody up so they can do their one-liner.
I'm available. I appreciate you.
You never know.
You haven't asked me.
So that's what we want to do and have real conversations about some of these issues in a funny way.
Right.
You know,
like almost like the old politically incorrect or something like that.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly
now, right. Before you run off, like what?
Yeah, that's a good example, by the way. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of like dealing with race, how do you see yourself in differentiating from Chris and finding yourself in the middle of that dialogue between the black community and the white community? What is the sort of, you know, the manifesto that you kind of,
Standby. Well, my thing is, I'm a contrarian, so I like to defy what you think I'm going to do. So I'm not, like, I never want to do the opposite of what you think. I'll always do the contrary.
Right.
You know?
Your type.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, so, and like I say, my personal opinion on things, I tell people I'm a passionate centrist, and I say what that really means is half the time I disagree with myself.
Right, okay.
You know?
Yeah.
That's what it really means.
Sure.
So I'm always on a search for the truth as opposed to I have an agenda that I'm trying to get across constantly.
Right.
Which is a different standpoint.
Right.
So that's why I may change my point of view on something based on the evidence.
So that's almost like what do you call it, Socratic?
Absolutely. It's very Socratic, you know. And So my black point of view will always be surprising because it's not based on one notion of it all the time.
Right.
So like one of the first bits I did on The Daily Show was I was kind of slamming Black History Month.
Right.
But that's, I mean, like the most of the times the joke on Black History Month is why do we get February? Why is it the shortest month?
Right.
So it's always defending Black History Month. And I was attacking it.
Right.
You know,
right.
Which is a different point of view.
And to make a different point.
Right. But yet I had a good point for why I was doing it. And John's like, well, Larry, what do you have against it? I'm like, John, 28 days of trivia to make up for 400 years of slavery? I'd rather we got casinos, you know.
Right.
And that's like my take on that. You know,
right.
Give me something I could really use. You giving me like Trivial Pursuit for 28 days? I don't don't think so. Right, you know, give me, how come the Indians got fucking casinos?
Right,
you know?
Right. Where's our payback?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that's my point of view. I'm going to get to another truth in there that is not and, is not the, the general
and,
truth.
And by being know. A contrarian, it supplies you with you know, an almost unending capability to sort of turn it.
Exactly.
Right.
Cause, and I'm scooping out my truth on
right,
it,
right.
Not what everybody else thinks. So I may defy the position you think I'm going to take, or I may be on the same side.
Right.
I may be on the left, I may be on the right.
But it's still going to be contrarian.
It's still going to be contrarian, exactly.
Well, good luck with the new show.
I appreciate it, Mark.
And it's great talking to you, man.
Thanks, you too.
Okay, that's it. That's our show. I hope you enjoyed that. He's a good guy. He's a sharp guy. Wish him the best of luck with that new show. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Yeah. Yeah, do that. Get the app. Got a hell of a catalog going. Got a hell of a catalog going. Do what you got to do. Okay? Got an interesting episode on Thursday. Bob Rubin. Do a little research. Do a little research. Bob Rubin. Comedian. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to tune my guitar for you. It's a little sad for a Boomer lives!